Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program.
Good evening, good to be with you. You may have heard, and it would be surprising if you didn't, that though there are maybe 500,000 Australian Muslims in Australia, there seems to be tension in the air. Let's say, since the release of two reports in particular, two pieces of research which have shown that the things that are being said within One Nation and by other groups about concerns about Muslim immigration and a settlement in Australia are shared by a surprisingly large number of people. You could perhaps have heard, well, not so long ago, the Sonia Kruger grab on air when she was on TV.
Personally, I would like to see it stop now for Australia, because I want to feel safe, as all of our citizens do, when they go out to celebrate Australia Day. And I'd like to see freedom of speech. And Lisa, I think, you know, we're seeing journalists
threatened. I'd like to see freedom of religion as well.
Just to clarify, Sonia, are you saying that you would like our borders closed to Muslims at this point?
Yes, I would. I would. Because I think at this
Which
point...
Which is the Donald Trump approach.
I think we had something like 500,000 now in our country. Well, perhaps it is, but for the safety of the citizens here, I think it's important.
And then, of course, Pauline Hanson has been re-elected to Senate. And in her maiden speech, she said a number of things which I think really energised debate, shocked some people, but energised debate. Here's a bit of that speech.
Now we are in danger of being swamped by Muslims who bear a culture and ideology that is incompatible with our own. If you are not prepared to become Australian and give this country your undivided loyalty, obey our laws, respect our culture and way of life, then I suggest you go back where you came from. Islam sees itself as a theocracy. Islam does not believe in democracy, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, or freedom of assembly. It does not separate religion and politics. It is partly a religion, but much more than that. It has a political agenda that goes far outside the realm of religion. It regulates Muslims' social and domestic life, their legal system and politics, their total life. Muslims are imprisoned at almost three times the average rate. The rate of unemployed and public dependency is two to three times greater than the national average. Muslims are prominent in organised crime, with associated violence and drug dealing. Antisocial behaviour is rampant, fuelled by hyper-masculine and misogynist culture. Therefore, I call for stopping further Muslim immigration and banning the burqa, as they have done in many countries around the world. In addition, no more mosques or schools should be built, and those that already exist should be monitored with regards to what they are teaching until the present crisis is over. Sharia law should not be acknowledged or allowed, and Australian companies should be banned from paying for halal certification.
Now, of course, there was much more to that speech. That's just a few bits and pieces of it. And it would be fair to say that 5% of our nation voted for One Nation. But there have been also results of a Deakin University survey released this week, a fortnight after that particular speech was made. And along with an essential poll, which was conducted last week, which found that 48% of Australians agree that we should have a national debate about Muslim immigration, the Deakin survey seems to confirm that Hanson's views are not just those of a tiny fringe minority, that a significant portion of the Australian population shares some of her fears and her concerns. Now, Australia has form on this stuff, of course. Indigenous Australians were not citizens until the 1960s. The Yellow Peril was a long anxiety our nation had from the gold rush onwards. And indeed, our local newspapers wrote rather nastily about Jewish refugees who arrived by boat after the Holocaust, and somehow thinking that the reporting on their furs and their jewels were more important to talk about than the concentration camps that actually fled. So look, that being said, we thought it would be good to talk out some of these recent findings and look at what they might mean and the context they come from, how they might affect Australia's half a million Muslims, and how we might be able to respond better. Joining us to do that, we have an illustrious panel for you again. In our Melbourne studios, Dr. Matteo Vergani. Now, Matteo did that Deakin study. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation, and a lot of his work focuses on political violence, its causes, its impact on society. He's originally from Italy, but he's been here for 4 years. Dr. Matteo Vergani, welcome to the program.
Hello, welcome, and thank you for hosting me, and good night.
And also in our Melbourne studio, Dr. Danny Nalia. Now, Pastor Danny Nalia is a Pentecostal pastor, and he's the founding director of the Rise Up Australia Party, founded in 2010. It has a reasonably strong anti-Muslim immigration platform, and they fielded candidates in both houses in the 2013 and 2016 federal elections, and he stood for the Senate. Dr. Danny Nalia, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be back on the air once again with ABC.
Good to have you. And in Sydney studio, we have Silma Ihram. Now, if you saw Silma's school on ABC, you will know that she is an educator and had a well-documented struggle in founding a Muslim school. And that was the Noor Ahura Islamic College in Sydney. And she's been a strong campaigner for social tolerance. Welcome to the program, Silma.
Thank you again. Very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And also in our Sydney studio here, we have Nusra. Now, Nusra is, in fact, Metwali, is a policy advisor, a community advocate and a lawyer. And she's a member of the fact-checking One Nation team. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. My name's Yusra, for the record.
Yusra. Did I say Yusra? It's Yusra. I've got to pronounce it properly.
Thank you.
I used to teach girls in school. I used to get in trouble for spelling Elizabeth wrongly. There's so many ways to do it. Let's begin with Dr. Vergani, if you don't mind. Your survey, could you just give us a little bit of context? Because it seems that your survey found that 60% of people would be concerned if a relative married a Muslim.
Well, actually, we asked how concerned would people be if a close relative were to marry a person of Muslim faith. Yeah. And yes, the results add up, as you say. So about 60% would be in some way concerned. However, we asked how concerned. So let's say about 20% would be very concerned, 10% concerned, 11 moderately, and 15 slightly. So there is a variety in these as well. Yeah,
helpful to know. But those same findings said 30% would be concerned if the same person was a Buddhist or a Jew as well.
Exactly. So we can see that there is much more concerned about Muslims than Jewish Buddhists, and which are about 30%, same as Jewish, and 10%, about 10% Christians.
Mm, who were worried if their partner was a Christian. That
exactly.
was also a concern.
Yes.
Now, how much does that actually reflect who you were talking to? I mean, how big was the survey? Just give us some context for it.
Yes, the survey is the first wave of the Australian Survey of Social Attitudes, so one of the most reliable surveys around. And yes, it is a preliminary findings because it comes in four waves all over the year. And it's about 300 people, a bit more than 300 people. And yes, exactly. This is what the snapshot says. But the most interesting finding, I think, is that we tried to explain why people are concerned. So we didn't stop asking, would you be concerned? But we also asked the other questions, and we found very interesting findings.
What did you tell us? We're dying to hear. What did you find?
Yeah. Well, actually, we found that the more people knew about Islam as a religion, the less prejudice they had against Muslims. So we asked five factual questions about Islam, like, is Jesus a revered prophet in Islam, for example, or what is the main religious text in Islam, etc. And then we combined the answers to form a index of knowledge, if you want, awareness, knowledge of Muslims, of Islam. And then we saw that the people who knew less about Islam as a religion were the same people who had more prejudice about Islam. Similarly, we asked, how many Muslim people do you know in your life? And surprise, we found very similar findings. So the more Muslim people the participants knew, the less prejudice about against Muslims and especially practicing Muslims. So, and last, a very interesting result was, of course, about terrorism. So the more the participants were anxious about terrorism, the less, the more prejudice they had against Muslims and the less knowledge of Islam as a religion they had. So there is a kind of an association between anxiety, low knowledge of Islam, and prejudice against practicing Muslims.
Yusra, that you're lighting up. I can see you want to say something.
Well, it's very interesting to know that when individuals have a understanding of Islam, they're more likely to be less prejudiced towards Islam. And it's interesting to note that someone like Pauline Hanson, who has quite a bit of prejudice about Islam, it's fair to say, does not actually want to make the effort to meet a Muslim, despite...
What's the context of that? Where do you mean the... Was this the tea invitation that we saw on television?
Well, she was invited by Mohammed Atay at the Q&A show, the one I attended as well.
Where you asked some questions too, yes?
No, I didn't get the chance to ask the questions, so that's why I wrote an opinion piece.
Okay,
and my question wasn't actually about her policies regarding Muslims. I decided to ask her a question about domestic violence and her views in relation to that. And because they weren't selected, I decided to write an opinion piece about that. On that note, men are, by and large, the perpetrators of domestic violence. Do we then say we're going to ban all men from immigrating to Australia? And the answer is no. So that's my view on banning Muslims, because there's a small element of radicalisation within the community. In terms of meeting a Muslim, Pauline Hanson turned down Mohammed Atai's invitation to have dinner with his family. And I actually decided to send her an email myself to invite her for a coffee. I thought I'd give her the benefit of the doubt, but she's refusing to sit down and actually learn about the religion, and that's why she's keeping up this rampage of prejudice and she's...
I don't think she likes it.
No, she doesn't like it.
Simba, you wanted to say something too.
No, I agree. I think part of the problem is, and it's very clear, whether it's Sonia Kruger or Pauline Hanson or... many of the Australian Muslim community, they're constantly bombarded with images of a violent, aggressive religion, forgetting that Muslims contributed a huge amount to the building of Australia. I mean, we've got the Afghans who opened up the interior. Mm. We've got the Macassans who established
traded in the north with indigenous people,
with the Aboriginal community for many years. So we've been here since the beginning. We've been here for a very long time. And I think this whole concept that Islam is this awful, scary religion, you can't blame anybody for thinking that. You really can't blame them. And we do have a lot of work to do in our own community to make sure that some of the issues that are surfacing here are dealt with. But it doesn't mean to say that you have to...
Every Muslim needs to go as...
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Pastor Danny Nally, can I bring you in here?
Yes.
First, I want to ask you a sort of an odd question. Because your party, the Rise Up Australia Party, I noticed when I was looking through some of the federal election figures... You know, you, I think, ran, 31 House of Representative seats?
Yeah.
And you got a best primary result about 5.6%.
That's correct.
In the Australian Labor-held seat of Brand. But then there were two seats that struck me. One was the West Australian street of Hasluck, and the Victorian street of Chisholm, where I think your preferences basically gave the seats to the Liberals. Is that fair enough to say?
Well, when an election is very close, a party like ourselves, who are fairly new into the game, do play a major role in putting a government into place, because the 5% plus vote that we got in those seats, I would say quite possibly did help a Liberal government get back into office. And I mean, that's the whole idea behind getting into the political arena, is to influence politics in such a way, because a small percentage on a very tight election could make a big difference. But taking it from there, I just also want to address some of the points brought before.
Sure.
By the, I can't remember the name of the dear lady who spoke
Nusra
on the other side.
And Silma.
Nusra. Regarding domestic violence. Now,
yes.
One of the things we also know is very clearly, I lived in Saudi Arabia.
I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you're going to talk about it.
I lived 40 minutes from Mecca. I myself, I'm a Christian. Mm-hmm. I was working there as a marketing executive. But while I was there, I took a keen interest on Islam and started studying the Quran to find out what's been told and what's been done, like Sharia law, beheadings, amputation of hands, whether this is real or is this just a Islamic regime carrying out an unlawful act of violence against their own citizens. But I was very surprised to read those verses in the Quran, which I can recite to you right now if you want to, but I would not take the time to do so. But it was very clear that in Islam, men dominated the women. A woman's right was only half the worthiness of a man, and a man had the right to beat a woman if she was suspected of having some sort of a connection with another man. And I read a lot of verses and I thought, while you stated made the statement regarding Australians' domestic violence, in homes, yes, there is domestic violence, largely influenced by alcohol. But unfortunately, in the Islamic world, the domestic violence is largely influenced by the Quran itself. And that's really counterproductive. I'd just like to see all the women's rights organizations rise up and stand with the Muslim women to protect them who have been abused, also at times given in marriage at 12 years old. So just want to put the record right. Also, I don't know whether Pauline Hanson did decline the invitation. She did accept the invitation on that interview on ABC. To the best of my ability or to my understanding, I don't think there was a follow-up from the gentleman who asked the interview in the interview for that meal that he invited her for.
And Danny Nally, it would be fair to say that you and Pauline Hanson have had a fair bit of contact, in fact, in terms of developing policy and that sort of stuff, I think, wouldn't it?
Well, we have been in constant conversation. I did speak to her quite a bit because I possibly would say that I gave her quite a bit of understanding of the Islamic teachings. Mm-hmm. But one thing I have been very, very clear in saying this. We got to understand this. Even though there is many terrorists who come out of the Islamic faith, all Muslims are not terrorists.
Of course.
So every time we talk, we should not use the word Muslims, but rather Islam. Because Muslims are equal citizens in this country. We got to love them, look after them, and protect them. But at the same time, stifling free speech and open debate on Islam and calling it Islamophobic, I think that's one of the greatest mistakes a nation can do. And I'd like to challenge every Islamic scholar, be like President Azizi, who spoke at the Al-Aqsa University, and he said this. He said, if we think we can continue the way we are continuing, calling everyone an Islamophobic when they talk out against Islam and win this battle, we are not going to win it. We need to address some of the fundamental teachings of Islam, of Prophet Muhammad, and change some of those teachings if you are to make any advance in the society we are living in.
So, Silma, perhaps to respond to some of that, because particularly the domestic violence stuff being inside the Quran.
There's definitely not the situation at all. And I think, although Danny might have, or Reverend Nalia might have some experience from living in Saudi Arabia, that is one very narrow-minded interpretation which is actually rejected by the vast majority of other Muslim countries. So
this is the Wahhabi school that's dominant there, and it's extremely strict.
For example, if you go to Indonesia or you go into Malaysia or you go into many of the other Muslim countries around the world, you'll find a very different approach. I think one of the things that's very important in this whole discussion about Sharia and the influence of Islam in a Muslim's life is that Islam is based on two sources, the Quran and the Hadith. The Quran is not explicit in how its principles are interpreted, the same way as the Constitution of Australia isn't, and the same way as many of the sources of law in Europe and many other countries. What happens is those who are scholars, and I would dispute with you that you are actually a scholar of Islam, the fact that you
I'm not, and I will not claim, to be one either.
So then it's up to the scholars to look at both the sources, the intent of the sources, and to apply them within the context, and also particularly to apply them in the context of the existing culture. So there's a lot of things that are taken into consideration with what's classified as Sharia, which is the way or the system of law, which, much like Australian law, is built on precedent. So you look at what people have done previously, what the Quran and the Hadith have done, what the Constitution has done, whichever body of law you're looking at, It's an interpretive law based on culture and what is in the best interests of the people in front of you at the time. So you can look at the worst case. I mean, we could look at America and say, do we want to have the same kind of system of executions that they have in America here? Well, we don't. And most and the vast majority of Muslims don't want to have the way the law in Saudi Arabia applies to Muslims here either.
Well, so, what I would like to say
so
is,
I think it's very, very important. Sorry, if I can finish it. I think it's very, very important that when you're looking at the worst case that you can think of, which is for most of us, I mean, let's look at what Saudi Arabia is doing.
Is what you mean. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Mm. So if you look at what they're doing historically, they're decimating our historical heritage, and there's many, many aspects of what Saudi Arabia has done that the rest of the Muslim world is really struggling with. And, you know, in every religion you have times when those who are teaching the religion are acting in the best interests and those who are not. So, for example, the Crusades was a terrible time in Christian history when they did a lot of terrible things. The recent Sri Lankan civil war.
Well, it depends on how you look at that, by the way, because I was taught the Crusades were an historic and wonderful time when we reclaimed it from Islam. I went to one of those schools. So, again, these are all perspective things.
But you need to read the history.
Can I come
exactly
in here?
How they roasted children alive and how the terrible things that they did at the time.
Yeah. Can I come in? As much as I understand where you're coming from, and I just want to confirm it to say that there are many Muslims who have decided to live a code of life which is away from the Quranic deep practices of the Quran. But you cannot deny the fact that Prophet Muhammad, in his autobiography, which is the Quran, made certain
that's
claims
not correct,
and statements.
Actually.
Well, that's true.
No, because the Quran and I'm very was, concerned
if the Quran's
that,
autobiography.
No, let me finish. Let me finish. I'll let you finish, so let me finish. Hold on. Let me finish.
One at a time. Danny, now you finish, then we'll correct it in a moment. Yeah.
And what I want to say is, in the Quran, it's very clear that a woman has half the right of a man. In the Quran, it does not say that a woman can have four men as their husbands, but it says a man can have four women as their wives.
Mm-hmm.
In a court of law, one witness is not enough. There has to be two witnesses if it's a woman giving evidence in a court of law. And it's not just Saudi Arabia. This form of Islam is practiced in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Malaysia, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon. Because it's the rule of law. It is the Quranic teaching. So as much as I know that there are many Muslims...
Are these cultures you're referring to, though, Pastor Danny Nali? These are cultural contexts where...
They are following the Quranic teaching. Mm. So as much as I say there are many Muslims who live a life which is outside the confines of the Quran, that they come to Australia to live a different life. But if you practice the Quran, that does not change you.
Right.
The Quran has to be practiced if you are a true Muslim.
Like, actually, I think, Danny, I think what you've taken are the references in the Quran to some specific things which are applied, as I said, again, in context. So, for example, a woman receiving half of the inheritance of her brother because she does not, under Islamic cultural practice and under Islamic requirements, what the principles of the Quran are, she doesn't have to provide for anybody. So her husband or her brother has to provide for all the women in his household, all of the daughters, all of the females, whereas a woman doesn't have to provide for anybody. So I think she actually gets a better deal by getting half of the inheritance compared to the men in the family. When it comes to witnesses, where a woman has to provide the same amount of as a man, there are a lot of complications in that. So a woman who has a kid, or a woman who is pregnant, or a woman who has family duties as a carer, which often happens in society today in Australia, it's a huge burden on her if she has to be present in a court case that might run 4 months, and she has to leave her family, leave her kids, and so on. So these are the allowances that exist and are interpreted in context in society. So you'll find Malaysia interprets a lot of these things differently to Indonesia, which interprets these things a lot very differently to the Maldives, to many different parts of the Muslim world. So to say that this is a blanket rule means that you don't understand how the Sharia is practiced both in theory
to my understanding,
and in reality.
Your explanation is another version to it, to make it look really good. And but that's not true. What I said is
well,
what
I'm
I stand
sorry,
by. For example,
I've been studying a lot longer than you have.
No, no. But also, when a woman goes to a courtroom and if the husband takes her into a Sharia court and says talal, talal, talal three times, I divorce.
That's talak.
She has no leg to stand on. Immediately, the divorce is granted by the Sharia law.
We could go through all of these specific issues because you know you could look at you know the Bible interpretation of the Bible. Some people ordain women. Some people don't. I don't know where you stand on that, for example.
Yeah, I have a lot of women on my leadership.
So you do it. But the other churches
yes.
that won't. Yep. And you can go through a lot of different things in Islam or Christianity, you know, the issue of homosexuality and whether you're going to include people or not. It's always fraught and complicated when you go into it. But what I'm interested in, though, is what's real and what's not real in this. And actually, can I bring you back, Dr. Matteo Vergani, because your research in what people believe about Islam or think about Islam and how much they actually know about it is important here because it also reflects in other countries, doesn't it? In the United States, for example, and other developed countries.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, this is a great discussion and I am enjoying it. But most of the public, I mean, I study the public opinion. This is my
yes.
job. And most of the public, they're not sophisticated in the sense that most of people do not really know about you know the Bible or the Quran
yes.
or the main religious text. Look, you would be surprised to know that when we asked to our sample in Australia, is Jesus a prophet in Islam?
Which he
20%
is.
Of people knew that it is.
Right.
Only 20%. When we asked, are the majority of Muslims Shia, Sufi, or Sunni? 13.5% knew that the majority are Sunni, etc., etc. So, really, people do not make decisions based on knowledge. People
right.
make decisions based on usually anxiety or other basic emotions, and this is what drives them.
Yusra, I think you wanted to jump in there.
Well, I think I find it quite concerning that Danny himself is talking about Islam within the confines of a really monolithic interpretation. He's really doing what the Saudis have done, which is destroying evidence of diversity and interpretations of Islam. And so what Danny...
But that's the Quran.
No, Danny, because the Quran...
I read the Quran.
It's reading it does not give you the right to give a fatwa and give a... give a stance because you have to study for many, many years. It's not black and white. And the Quran is applied according to context. So.
And it's not an autobiography of Muhammad.
Definitely not an autobiography of Prophet
His
Muhammad.
His name is mentioned once in there.
Yeah, so you really. Danny,
but,
Danny if you're.
Isn't it,
if
isn't
you,
it the, isn't
please
the
let
right
me finish.
Claim?
Please let me finish, Danny. I'll let you finish what you
okay,
were saying.
Go for it,
okay.
Yeah.
It's concerning to me that you are educating Pauline Hanson on Islam. That's really concerning to me because what you're doing is you're taking a black and white interpretation of the Quran and you're spreading it...
as though it's a reality.
That's right. So we have
but
concerns.
But doesn't the Quran claim that God gave this word to Muhammad?
It claims that God revealed through the angel Gabriel the same to Muhammad, the same way as he revealed to Moses, the same way as he revealed to Jesus, the same way as he revealed to Abraham, the same way as he revealed to Noah, all of the same way as he revealed to David. There are
the only difference is there are four books that the Muslims
believe in that were all revelations from God, and the Quran is the last of them. And,
but the difference is the violence carried out across the nations right now by thousands of people who shout Allahu Akbar, and you will say, of course, they are not Muslims, and they are put into one little box saying either they are mentally derailed or there's a problem. I think we need to really address that issue. There is something that they're going into the Quran and getting, which they are basically being brainwashed
to do what they're doing.
The
problem historically is that if you look at the history of civilizations, religion has been used by Buddhists in Sri Lanka, by Hindus in India, by Christians across the
Northern Ireland,
the Ku Klux Klan.
Serbia.
It's been used by so many people who have a political agenda for those who don't know and who are ignorant. This is the problem.
Let me say this.
And you're
Buddhism,
feeding right into that.
And also,
no, hold on. If a Buddhist acts violently, He's acting against the will of Buddha. Buddha never taught violence.
And on the same token, Muslims who commit violence actually
act
against the religion as well. So that's something they've got in common.
If a Christian commits violence, he's acting against the will of Jesus. Jesus never taught violence.
Exactly.
But if a Muslim does act violently, he's exactly practicing what Muhammad did.
Who gives you the right to say that?
Because Muhammad personally beheaded 600 to 800 people in Mecca.
He did not. Where did you get this rubbish from?
It is in the Quran.
Tell me what your source is.
It's in the Quran. He basically beheaded on the Al-Qureshi tribe.
I suggest you check your facts.
Let's just hold for a moment there, because we could go down this vortex.
It's not a matter to laugh it off.
No.
It's a real serious issue.
I'm amazed at this stuff. That
we're laughing because you are saying
as fact.
You're spreading lies. It's not based on fact.
Can I quote some Quranic verses for you right now?
Look, actually, I think that's not going to help, because a lot of this is about perception, isn't it, Matteo Vergani, this is what you've been looking at, what people perceive, not actually what they know, is key to this, isn't it?
Absolutely. Look, and this is true both, you know, if we look at the effect of, terrorism or the perception of threat from terrorism in the society, but also if we look at the causes of terrorism or, you know, the drivers, in most of the studies appears that ideology or religion or in any way cognitive aspects are not really the main driver. The main driver for joining a terrorist groups are usually need to belong or alienation sometimes certain ways. So this is what emerges from research across many different comparative research. So not only looking at terrorists from the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, but many other groups, even nationalist groups. Exactly.
Well, Nusra, can I bring you in there? Because economics is one of your interests.
That's right. And so one of the sort of thing that's been happening over time is that during times of economic uncertainty, there's almost an obsession with finding a scapegoat to blame all of society's problems, and
it was the Chinese in the gold rush.
That's right.
And then it was the WOGs in the 70s and 80s. I seem to remember when I was growing up, because I was often identified as a WOG because I looked a bit French. But it's now the Muslims.
WOGs.
They thought I was Italian because I looked a
bit French. Might be also called one.
Yeah, exactly. That's me, not you.
But this is Australia has form on this, honestly, Matteo. And I have to say, Danny and Nali, do you mind if I ask you? You're Sri Lankan. Surely you've been on the receiving end of people, you know, who have racist views. It's almost impossible to escape it in this country from time to time.
Surely, yes. I've been on the victim's end in that part of the world when I was there, and I fully understand that. That's why I'm very, very clear in stating we do not fight a people's group. We are coming against an ideology which needs to be dealt with, and we should not try to avoid talking about this. I'm very happy that we can openly discuss and walk away from here being friends and not enemies. And I think that we have to interact. We need more Muslim scholars coming out in the public and denouncing every act of violence carried out in the name of Islam, and make statements clearly from the rooftop of the mosque stating, if you die in jihad, you're not going to heaven, you're going to hell. You're not going to get 72 virgins in heaven, but you might face 72 demons in heaven. I think these are statements we need to hear more from the Islamic world. I've not heard one of those statements come from the two dear ladies who are seated in your studio right now.
Oh, no, I can tell you both of them have been quite articulate on this. But if you research what they've said, they've both been quite articulate about it. And I have to hasten to correct that straight away. Because this is another thing, Danny Nadia, that you hear people, whenever another crisis happens, you know, if there's another act of violence, you see people report in the press, oh, no, Muslim leaders are decrying it. Well, they do it all the time, and they're addressing it all the time. And it's almost like they have to discipline themselves from fatigue to remember, okay, another disaster's happened. I have to say this again. And they do it again. Silma, you're nodding.
Absolutely. And I've been looking at the media the last few days and the appalling crises that are happening in Syria. And I was listening to background to one of the Radio National shows about the amount of bombs that were dropped on Laos. How much do the churches protest and our mainstream religion religious bodies protest at the ongoing slaughter of what's happening in Syria, or you know what's happening in what happened previously in many of the interventions that have occurred in the Middle East. I mean, or what's happening with the Palestinians and the appalling ghettos that they're forced to live in, the apartheid system. Mm. When we look at it, unfortunately, there are a lot of things that are being done around the world that we need to protest about. And the Muslim community is constantly, whenever there is an issue that where the name of God is pronounced and used inappropriately, the Muslim community is constantly saying, this is not part of Islam, this is rejected by Islam. But it seems to be that it's a one-sided thing, that this tiny minority of Australian Muslims who have nothing to do with what is happening in Syria or in Iraq and so on are the ones who are held to account for what this rabid bunch of thugs are doing, while our governments are involved in appalling atrocities of bombing hospitals and UN aid convoys and all the terrible things that have been happening, and yet the majority community, which can influence our governments, so we have no influence. But the Muslim
would you consider the Australian Federation
those who
of
can
Islam
influence the Australian government and who have a majority say in this country are not protesting equally about the atrocities that are? In fact, they're saying now that the amount of deaths that have been caused by the bombing of civilians in Syria is way more than what Daesh has ever done.
And it's quite interesting.
I just have 2 points to bring up.
Can I please? Let's go.
First Nusra and then Danny, if that's okay.
Thank you. Okay, so it's interesting when we're having this debate about banning Muslim immigration. The vast majority of refugees are coming from Muslim countries because of the impact of foreign policy.
Yeah.
So why are they coming from Afghanistan, Iraq, an invasion which was not based on any rational fears?
But they're fleeing, basically. They're fleeing for their lives. That's what's happening.
Right.
Well, no, but we've signed up to the UN Refugee Convention. I would point out, Dr. Danny, and that means that what we've signed up to, and it says really clearly, is that you can't discriminate on the basis of race or religion. It actually says
so
that.
We don't blame ISIS for doing the things that people need to flee those countries.
Danny,
but
ISIS came.
America and Australia for going to rescue the people who are getting tortured there.
Danny, ISIS, very recent. Okay, the invasion of Iraq happened in 2003. So between 2003 and when ISIS was formed, there was a vacuum of power, and ISIS came and seized that power. Okay, and that's why,
seeing before ISIS, it was Al Qaeda.
Al Qaeda were trained by the CIA. So it's very political. You're laughing about it. It's quite serious. So that just shows to you that the causes of terrorism is not ideology. It's largely, politics. By and large, politics. Okay?
Now, let me
finish what I'm saying, please, Danny.
No, I thought you finished.
Danny, no. I'm still talking, okay?
We should be very calm.
And I've been calm enough to listen to what you're saying, so I'd appreciate the same level of respect, please, okay?
Sure, go for it.
Right. So,
but don't be too long. Give me a chance to talk.
We've got 15 minutes. Don't you worry.
No.
I'm watching the clock. That's why.
We should take some calls, in fact. 1-300-800-222. Let me just say 1-300-800-222. You've got a question for this panel, but please, Nusra.
Okay. Right. So, if you look at radicalized youth, a lot of them are not acting out of ideology. In fact, many terrorists have been found with books like The Dummy's Guide to Islam. So that just shows you that they're acting out not out of ideology, out of a range of reasons, including alienation, mental illnesses, which we can't discount. Because let's face it, when there's a white man, a white teenager standing behind a barrel in the USA, never heard the word terrorism. Okay, so that's something that we should take into account.
You're talking about Dylan, what's his name, and those
Dylan
boys.
Roof.
Dylan Roof. Yeah.
Right.
Pentecostalist terrorist, I've got to say, Danny Nalia too. He was a Pentecostalist terrorist, I think.
Mm. Who is this?
Dylan Roof. I think that's what he was at. He was at a Bible
study. I thought you said Darren Hinge.
No. Close enough.
Okay. Now, my question is, the Islamic Federation of Australia, would you consider that to be a moderate body of representative of Muslims
for
the
Muslim
community?
Well, this is all
Muslim
I can say, actually. I'm not actually quite familiar.
It'd be a personal opinion, I presume, yeah, that you're asking for.
But the reason I'm asking you that is the Australian Federation of Muslims approached the Australian government twice to implement Sharia law. And my question is, what's wrong with the law that we have in this country? You came into this country, you embrace this country, become a part of this country, and don't try to change this country to where you have come from. That has been my call from day number one. And why ask for Sharia law twice? It was declined, but the approach has been there very strongly to implement Sharia law.
Do you mean for marriage or which one do you mean?
Well, whatever it is, I don't want another set of laws to be implemented in Australia.
Well, no
we
one's
have
asking
our laws.
For another set of laws, actually.
The Australian Federation of Australia did ask for Sharia law twice in the Julia Gillard government.
Can I jump in there, though, to make a point? Because, Pastor Danny Nalia, I think it's important to remember that the Beth Din operates in Australia. That's a Jewish set of courts that administers Jewish law inside Australia. And, for example, there's a thing called the Marriage Tribunal, which the Catholic Church has, and that is implementing canon law inside Australia. So we have – it's under the law of the land, by the way. You can't – it doesn't overrule the law of the land. But we have religious law already in this country. And I'd venture to say, Silma, is it not true to say that people are already practicing Sharia, whether it's officially acknowledged or not? That would be what a Muslim does.
It depends what you call by Sharia. Sharia, the vast majority of Sharia relates to – your personal religious practice. So whether you get up for, the prayers, what time the prayers occur, the fasting, Ramadan, the timing of the moon in how it affects the calendar dates, how you perform your pilgrimage, these are all the most important parts of Sharia law.
Which you do.
And Sharia, in effect, has to obey the law of the land. It cannot be an individual overriding the rules of the state. So if unless it prohibits them from performing their religious practice.
Well,
so,
what you said, Noel, is right, because there are two Sharia courts operating in New South Wales.
That's in relation to marriage.
Which was illegal.
No, it's not illegal. No. It's in relation to...
It is illegal. It's under investigation because Australian Family Court...
That's an allegation. That's an allegation you're making, I think. And if it's being investigated, I'd be interested to know what that means.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, let me explain. The Australian Family Court basically granted a divorce to a Muslim woman who went to the court, which was overruled by the Sharia law in Lakemba. And that's what's now the woman went back to the courts, and then the police are now investigating this case. It was on National 7 News.
Right. I'd have to research that to get across it.
Yes, but they're not allowed to do that anyway. It's not valid. So somebody can say, a man can say, I disagree with what the court did, and unfortunately there are some men who do, and they kill their wives as a result. This is a huge problem that we have in this country, actually, with the domestic abuse and not accepting the family court's decision. It doesn't mean to say that it's valid.
So but in this case, Sharia law, overruled the family court's law.
Well, there is no such thing as a Sharia court. There is a group of imams that meet together to give advice on the interpretation of Islamic law and encourage marriages to stay together and to give the Islamic divorce or the Islamic marriage, which is overruled by the court where necessary. I mean, the court is the one that has the legal law in this country, not the imam's advice.
I have to do a quick piece of program identification, because you're on ABC Radio around Australia with me, Noel Debien. Our panel at the moment consists of Dr. Matteo Vergani, who's a postdoctoral research fellow at Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation. Now, he's done the study, the Deakin survey that you've seen or heard about on attitudes towards Muslims in Australia. Also, Silma Iram here is really an Australian pioneer of education, of Muslim education in this country, and a former school principal, and she was the one who founded the Noor al-Huda Islamic College in Sydney, and a campaigner on tolerance, basically. Pastor Danny Nalia, Dr. Danny Nalia, who's a Pentecostal pastor and founding director of Rise Up Australia in Melbourne, and also here in Sydney, Yusra Metwili, who's a policy advisor, community advocate and lawyer. Now, we should take a couple of calls, because people are, I knew they would. Mm-hmm. Let's just take a couple of calls here and go to, have I got you, Daniel, in Strathmore?
You do, Noel.
What would you like to say?
Oh, gee, I don't know, this is all going to get squeezed. I was just going to recount I've got 2 points, and everything sort of moved on.
Tell me,
so
yep.
I was going to recount how I was in a shop yesterday, and everyone was busy. It was grand final day, so it was all happy, but then there was this sort of two discussions. This woman was talking about how she came to Australia as an immigrant and how the Aborigines were the first people, etc. And she said, these were the first people. There's no, there shouldn't be any debate about it. Go back to where you came from.
Thank you.
But then I said to her, well, it doesn't sound likely you'd vote for One Nation. Well, then the volcano erupted.
Oh.
Mm.
And she looked at me, and I got the rudest tirade in my life, finished with F off and leave.
Oh, dear. So it wasn't civil. Yeah.
In quotes, my Australia alone. Now, I'm obviously Australian going back way and not really, I'm trying to undermine per Australia or whatever that means.
Right.
But it was absolutely bizarre to see this, you know, person who seemed to be really, you know, heading one way, arrived in Australia, migrant, irrespective of the Aboriginal people, and then just explodes.
You can't always tell, can you, really?
No, yes.
But can I just raise my second point?
Yes, quick.
Briefly. Now, I think
we've got a pile of calls, so we've got to make it quick.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I kind of think that we'd be having two discussions.
We are.
One discussion.
Having three, actually.
Four. Plenty. In one discussion, let's say everyone was involved with talking about the negative attitude towards Islam in Australia. And then, you know, everyone would be saying, look, you really just don't understand things, and trying to educate people.
Yeah.
But if, say, you know, we were people who were contributors to the journal Critical Muslim, for instance, which is a
I don't know that journal.
I read. Oh, it's fantastic.
Oh, I better look it up.
Oh, it's wonderful. Well, you know, it's got lots of stuff on Islamophobia, but I had a brilliant article on, say, misogyny in Islam. Now, it wasn't undermining the original text of Islam, but it talked about, you know, it said, unfortunately, the whole masculine side of Allah had been so colonised and very colonised by the Saudi form, which has been pumped out since the 70s all over the globe, being petrodollars.
Silver's nodding.
Yeah, and there is the whole feminine side of Allah that has been just missed in script.
Oh, they're looking quizzically. We've really got to move on. It's a really interesting call. I mean, you are really interesting. But I've got other people. We've only got six minutes to go. Thank you very much. Let's go to Jim in Wollongong. Have I got you?
Yes, you.
Jump in. What did you want to say, Jim?
I just wanted to briefly say that I think it's a little unfair to say that all the people that we don't like of our religion are not true to that religion. Like, if I just said Westboro Baptist, they're not Christian, I think that would be a lie, because they derive their ideology from their interpretation of our sacred text. So they believe that they're Christian. And I don't think we can just say the far extreme Saudi interpretation of Islam, just wipe it and say, no, sorry, that's not true Islam, and only the very intelligent progressive interpretation that these ladies have.
Intelligent progressive, there you go. I think that's a gold star on ABC Radio. I think.
No, I mean, they do sound extremely intelligent, and they probably studied.
There's plenty of us, I promise. We're not the only ones.
I assure you. I went to uni and I met many very intelligent Muslim people, but I also went to high school with very many unintelligent Christians and Muslims who would just quote randomly passages that they had
proof texts,
knowledge of. Now, you'll find, same as these ladies, very intelligent biblical scholars in Christianity who can pull out wonderful gems from the Old Testament, little things that have snuck in there and been held onto over time that reveal God's love and mercy and feminine side of God. They're all there, but we do have to be honest and accept that the plain reading of the Quran and the Old Testament, the plain, simple reading that most people will have, does present a lot of violence. I mean, in the Old Testament,
let's take that aboard. I've got to get. I think you made your point, Jim. I've got to get some responses.
Can I quickly respond?
And then
Look,
Danny.
I take your point, but there is a very big difference between the interpretation of the Bible and the interpretation of the Quran. We don't have the original text of the Bible. This is one of the biggest issues for scholars. We don't have the original text, so it's very hard then to say exactly what Jesus actually said at the time, because we don't have any recordings of what he actually said in Aramaic at the time. We do have of the Quran. So there is a whole science that has been built, which is reflected in the schools of law and the huge amount of scholarship, which has largely been not taught over the last few centuries, which is why we have so much ignorance. But we cannot say that somebody who says, I believe in God and I believe in the Prophet, is not a Muslim. That is something which is becoming a lot more common these days and is also rejected in Islam. So we're not saying that. But in terms of whether they are presenting but with this violence and so on against the teachings of Islam are not a matter of interpretation as much as it is in perhaps other religions. So yeah. I think I take your point.
Okay, can I come in?
We've actually got to wind up, so yes,
sorry,
Danny.
Danny.
I'd just like to conclude by saying this. One thing for sure is in the Bible, Jesus never taught violence. He said, if someone slaps you on one side, give the other side.
He also said, love yourself. I came to bring a sword between a father and his son.
Yeah, you've got to understand that why he said it. He said when a person wants to stand up for Jesus and if someone stops him, then have love and care, but also you might have to leave your home and go and continue to serve Jesus. So Jesus came to give love. He said, love your neighbor as yourself, turn your cheek to the other person. And I believe if you can take some of those principles and implement it, I think the world will be a better place to live in.
Look, I agree. Look, I think, again, going deeply into Scripture is something we can do on this panel, but I'm just thinking that,
minutes.
Again, not even in an hour, but Matteo Vergani, before we go, how much did your research actually show that increased knowledge about Islam starts to diffuse this sort of real fear and anxiety of it? How much was that shown by your research?
Absolutely. This is our main finding. So there is a clear association between knowing about Islam, which is actual factual knowledge, because we also asked some questions about self-perceived knowledge. So we asked people, how much do you think you know about Islam?
Right.
And, well, this was not correlated with any measure of prejudice.
Yeah, you'd have to do a lot more to find out how much they actually did know, but I get
absolutely
the point.
Absolutely. It's really different. And there was an association above and beyond other factors. So beyond formal education, beyond party ideology, beyond income, social class, etc. So this association is very strong.
Well, look. Thank you very much. I know that we haven't solved the problems of the world in this conversation, but we have, I think, at least started to experiment a bit on where this is in terms of anxiety inside the country. And Pastor Danny Nalia, I wonder, do you feel that Islam is something you could learn more about too? I mean, is that something that you're interested in doing?
Oh, yes, definitely, because I think the Bible says for a lack of knowledge, people perish. So I think it's important for us to understand more. The more we understand, I just want to say this. I just really appreciate having this conversation and also the two ladies there. Thank you for being on the program. It's lovely to talk to you all.
Thanks, Danny. And you're welcome. We're happy to come
we're happy
meet
to
you.
Chat.
We've just dipped our toe in the water. That's all we've managed
to
do.
Right.
But thanks to our panel in this hour. That's Dr. Matteo Vergani, who did the research, Silma Ihram, who's here in Sydney, with Pastor Danny Nalia, Dr. Danny Nalia in Melbourne, and Yusra Betwali, lawyer and advocate.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.